You invest your money to give yourself the highest likelihood of reaching your goals, right? So how do you know if your investments are actually helping you reach your goals? And what do you do if your investment properties are underperforming? That's what I'm going to be discussing with Brett Warren today. And my chat is going to be helpful whether you're a beginning investor or if you already have a substantial portfolio. I think you're going to get some benefit whether your properties are performing well, and particularly if they're underperforming, because what we're going to be talking about are some basic investment fundamentals, things that are going to help you through the challenging times we're currently experiencing, but more importantly, to take advantage of the new property markets that are emerging in front of our eyes. And in my mindset moment, I'm going to share some life lessons from Bill Gates. I recently watched a documentary about Bill Gates, and there were some great lessons from one of the world's richest people, so why not take his advice? Welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropol, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
How are your properties performing? Are they achieving the results that you're expecting? I know when clients or prospects sit with our team at Metropol, they sometimes ask, hey, can you tell me, is my property portfolio going to get me to where I want to get to? Most of the time, they already know it's not performing as well as it should. So to understand what you should do if you own a dud property that's not increasing in value, let's have a chat with Brett Warren, my business partner and director of Metropol. Welcome, Brett.
Thanks, Michael. How are you going?
Good, thank you. Now, I know that people come along and they wonder, should I buy, should I sell? What's the best option if I've got a dud property that's not performing? What's your take on this? How do you attack this problem?
Yeah, look, it's obviously two ways to look at it. Firstly, there's the property in isolation and how I feel about the property or how the property is performing, and generally and how it fits into their overall portfolio as well. But as you can imagine, Michael, probably one of the most common things I get told is, if they do hold a dud property or a property that's not performing, I guess one of the get-out clauses is, well, at least my portfolio is not costing me anything, or at least it's not costing me anything. It's not growing in value, but it's not costing me anything.
Well, they're wrong, aren't they, Brett? It is costing them.
It could be costing them a huge amount, obviously the opportunity cost, and that's one thing we start to get in, break into detail. If you've got a property that's performing at 1% per annum, and it's a $500,000 or $600,000 property when it could be performing at 6 or 7%. There's a considerable difference over a 5 or 10 year period, and that's going to help get you into your next property and grow your wealth significantly faster.
Sure. So I think unfortunately many people have bought a property hearing that the Sydney property market's gone up around 8% per annum, as has Melbourne and Brisbane over the last 4 decades. So they just think they can buy any property and increase in value. Unfortunately, that's not true. They're averages, and while the averages are right, we know that figures, well, you can get anything out of figures, can't you? So some properties are going to outperform while others are going to underperform. That's how averages work. So what sort of questions would you be asking somebody if you sit down with them and they say, well, how's my property performing?
Sure. Look, the first thing I'd like to understand, I think 90% of property investors, they don't have a plan or a strategy. They don't understand what they're trying to achieve. I always use the holiday analogy where you fly into the airport, you know where you're going to stay and the sights and sound. And most property investors just buy a couple of properties, they end up in the air and they hope they're going to land where they're going to land. But there's no real plan or strategy there. So the first thing I'd like to understand is what their plan is and what is their overall strategy.
I think that's really important because if you want to understand how it's performing, is it that they're looking for cash flow? Is it looking that they're looking for capital growth? What's their end game? Because it's got to be judged. The performance has really got to be judged in the context of what their expectations are.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's a couple of questions I always like to ask. So, is this property performing like you expected it to? What were their expectations? Is the property outperforming the market? Look, Michael, I sat with someone today and you always say sometimes you've got to be careful you don't get it right the first time. The person was crowing that they'd had 4% or 5% growth and they were really happy with that. But when you compare that to what could have happened in the Melbourne market, you know, there's a 7% or 8% growth factor that happened in that particular market. So it's quite a remarkable difference. So they may feel like they've got it right the first time, which can be dangerous. I also like to ask the question, if this property were on the market today, would you buy it again? I think that's a very powerful question because that's a very straight, direct question that the person can't ignore.
Unfortunately, they look at you, they pause, and they usually say no. And then my answer is, so why do you still own it? I'm a little bit more forthright than you. But I know you get around to that in the end anyway, Brett.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the other thing is, Michael, you know, we are heading into a time of, you know, low inflation and wages growth and things like that. So are there any more improvements we can make to this particular property to maybe boost the value or boost the cash flow? And then finally, I guess doing a little bit of analysis to understand how it's going to perform moving forward. So they may have got it right or wrong in the past, but how's it going to perform? Is it going to perform above average and produce above average rates of return of growth for the next decade?
I agree with what you're saying. There's another question I like to ask to get an indication of why they chose that, how they chose that. So I often ask something along the lines of the 300,000 properties that were on the market at any one time when you bought your property, why did you choose this one? And you'll often find it relates to somebody with a vested interest that's recommended it, a property marketer, or maybe it's a friend or a colleague or a real estate agent. Because when we see properties that have underperformed, they tend to be particular sorts of properties. And we can see this every quarter. The CoreLogic brings out its pain and gain reports. So you can see the sort of properties that in general have not performed well and people sell up and lose money. The new and off the plan markets in the middle of the CBD, we know that in general they've had minimal, if any, capital growth in the first decade. We know that the house and land packages in the outer suburbs, where there's lots of physical growth and people see a lot of activity happening around them, but they actually don't get much capital growth. We've definitely seen it in people who chase the next hotspot, people who unfortunately bought in Darwin when it was growing fast, or in Logan in Brisbane, there's been a number of people recommending that. And while there's been huge growth, lots of new estates, it didn't have all the growth drivers that areas should have to get capital growth. We saw that a decade ago in the mining towns. And unfortunately, we've also seen it in properties located in some of the lower socioeconomic areas where there's been minimal growth. So I think it's important to understand what motivated them, what their thoughts were. And it's not to make them feel bad, but it's many people have got a lot of emotional attachment to their property. They spent a lot of time, effort, energy. And to be blunt, there's also a level of ego involved. People don't like admitting they've made mistakes. So sometimes they've got to recognize that. But by the way, we frequently say it takes the average property investor 30 years to become financially independent because the first 10 years, you make all those mistakes. Now, we try and prevent those mistakes by helping them right at the beginning at Metropol. So we help a lot of beginning investors avoid those first 10 years of mistakes. But I've made lots of mistakes, and I know as an investor, you did in your early days too, Brett.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's the benefit of, you know, I guess, learning and having a mentor and having someone to guide you in the right direction. I would suggest that probably, to be honest, Michael, 80 or 90% of these people have bought these locations based on a gut feel or a hunch or potentially the latest fad that they're chasing or something. And I guess to tie it in with what I said before about, you know, it's really important to have a plan and a strategy for where you're heading. It's also important to have a bit of a plan and a strategy and a selection process for the particular property you're looking at. And look, we've got that level of experience, but we also make decisions based on facts, data and numbers rather than having that gut feel.
Sure. So if we're going to look at areas that are more likely to outperform, we keep saying that we've got to have multiple growth drivers. What are you looking for, Brett?
Yeah, so there's a number of those types of things. Look, a lot of people talk about population growth, but we're narrowing down a little bit and talking about household formation. So if a couple has a young child, they're not really going to form another household because it's within that house. So we need to understand where new houses are being formed. I always talk a little bit more about wages growth, probably more than that, the average person, but I really believe it's going to be critical in the next 4 or 5 years as inflation and growth is going to be quite low. And I would suggest around 90 to 95% of Australians, their wages aren't growing. So we need people with higher rates of income, multiple streams of income and things like that. And that's the type of demographic we need with strong, stable incomes.
Now, interestingly, what you said a moment ago, Brett, is you're right that wages aren't going up, but people who have multiple streams of income are important. So I know you have, I have, but a lot of our clients also have some their own businesses, they have shares, they have dividends, they have a gig on the side, they have multiple streams of income, and so therefore their wages go up more than average, which gives them the ability and the desire to pay more for their properties, and they're the sort of areas that we're looking for. So it's not a judge of people, but interestingly, the Australian Bureau of Statistics and the Census does break down suburb by suburb what wages growth is like compared to average. So we're looking for areas where wages are growing faster than the average for that state.
Yes, and continually growing above average, and that's very important. And I guess that leads to the next, you know, factor as well that's important is gentrification. So the older retirees or the lower socioeconomic people are moving out of the area and the young families are coming in with higher incomes. And then they're knocking over houses, they're refurbishing places. And, you know, if you've got the little property tucked around the corner or in a street that's really undergoing change and all of a sudden there's $1 million or multi-million dollar homes popping up, then that's putting upward pressure on your property as well. And you actually haven't physically lifted a finger. So that's another pillar and another tool we have as well, Michael.
Sure. So as we're looking for growth drivers, we've talked about household formation, wages growth, demographic changes, gentrification. I think moving forward, livability and amenity is going to be important. People are going to remember 2020 and be prepared to pay a premium to live in a way that they feel safe and comfortable.
Yes, certainly. And I think a huge factor also is actually having, you know, another word pillars or multiple aspects of lifestyle around them. So lifestyle precincts, coffee shops, restaurants, good schools, public transport, green space, all within, you know, walking distance from their residence. And you're 100% right, they'll be prepared to pay a premium. And if we're buying in the areas where wages are continually growing, then they can afford to pay a premium, which is important as well.
Sure. Of course, the other areas, once we do the homework to see which locations are going to outperform the long term, we look for the correct supply and demand ratio. We don't want outer suburbs where there's so much vacant land that there's always another estate or another estate, or in the inner suburbs where there are too many new infill developments happening. And infrastructure is another thing that will lead to capital growth. But really, Brett, we need multiple pillars. Just one of these isn't alone, is it?
No, it's not. You work together as a team almost, and you know, just by having a train line somewhere or a library somewhere, it doesn't automatically lead to capital growth, and that's definitely something we've seen in the past.
So what we were talking about really is what you do with an underperforming property. What we just discussed a second ago, I guess, was what the opposite is of why some locations are going to outperform. Of course, once you've found that location, then you've got to find the right property in the location. And that's where you need the on-the-ground perspective. So it's a combination of data, numbers, figures, the stuff we've just talked about, and then also science, the perspective of understanding why one side of the street is different to the other, why one area in a suburb is different to the other. And that's where you need the local knowledge of many, many years, not just what's changed recently. I guess that's partly why our team at Metropole have got the edge over others. We don't fly in, fly out. Our team are on the ground. They know what's going on. And this helps home buyers and also investors. And in my mind, I don't know, I'm biased, the investment in using our services at Metropole protects people, keeps them safer, makes it less likely for them to make mistakes. But back to our initial discussion, Brett. Okay, you've sat with a client, you've found they've got an underperforming property. What do you do?
Well, the next thing is we basically break it down into four categories. And usually if it's underperforming, it falls into one of these categories. So the first one's timing. They may have bought at the top of a cycle or a peak of a cycle. And, you know, obviously after that period of time, generally in a property cycle, Michael, the boom and the rise is probably the shortest period. So if you're buying at the top of a boom, it's a long way back before the next boom comes along. So timing is a critical factor there. The next One is price, and sometimes obviously people paying too much for property. Now, that may be a property on the market, but I'd also argue these people that are paying potentially brand new or off the plan, they're likely paying 10 to 15% too much because they're paying project marketers fees and kickbacks and things like that. And they've generally given away up to a decade's growth, with kickbacks and commissions and things like that. So there is paying too much, but there's also people who not sure that they pay too much because it's all hidden in the contract price and, you know, potentially rental guarantees and things like that. Probably the most obvious one for me and something I can tell straight away is location. If people are buying in outer areas where there's a huge amount of supply or the wrong type of property, even in the right location, you know, even a property on a main road in a great location is not going to perform as well as other areas. And that's quite easy to understand. And then finally, having an actual look at the property itself and understanding, you know, was it poor property selection? Did they buy in the wrong part of the suburb, or was there something wrong with the property in terms of the slope or the gradient or something like that?
Well, so as you say, we analyze why the property hasn't performed. And if it's poor timing, but it's the right property in the right location, then that's a little bit of bad luck, but you hold on because the property market's very forgiving. Similarly, if you've overpaid, but it's the right sort of property, but you got excited at auction and you paid too much, again, the property market's reasonably forgiving. Of course, you mentioned about the paying too much for off-the-plan properties. The people who buy those tend to suffer in a couple of ways. As you say, they give away a large percentage of their capital growth the first up to decade to the developer, and it's not his to have. But the valuers recognize that. They recognize that if you were to sell that property a year or two down the track, it's no longer new, so you can't get the depreciation allowances. You're not going to have the couple of years of rent guarantees that start off. So they will very often value a new property that you bought off the plan. I mean, they value it eventually on completion so you can get finance considerably below the contract price because they recognise that if it was to come onto the market again, it wouldn't achieve that price. So there's a double whammy there that people suffer. Location, well, we're working through the four reasons that in general properties don't perform. 80% of the heavy lifting is done by the location. And you can't change that. You can't, and you shouldn't compromise on that. Then, of course, you've got to have the right property itself. So I believe that there are times when you've actually got to have a look at it and say, well, should I sell that? The answer to these questions that we've discussed is going to help ensure that you only retain top performing properties. Now, it's important to do that because your money's going to run out before the opportunities will. So if you can only own two or three properties or four or five properties, you've got to own the best ones you can. So while one may only grow 1 or 2 or 3% more per annum, and in the early days it doesn't look like much, the power of compounding is that, you know, you've seen those charts that the further out you go, the wider the gap is between one property's performance and the other. And I like buying properties to allow me to buy more properties. So if my property goes up in value, I can then use the equity in that property to buy the next one, and the cash flow that goes up, the rents go up because the property's gone up in value, to service the debts for the next one. So at Metropole, we help our clients build substantial property portfolios. We're there to help you whether you're a beginner or already an experienced investor. What we do is we actually help you buy properties that are going to help you buy more properties. But, Brett, occasionally we have to say you've got to actually cut your losses. You've got to sell that underperforming property. That must be an awkward conversation with people.
Yeah, look, it certainly can be, Michael. And you spoke a little bit before about emotion and ego and things like that, and it can be hard to talk that through. But once you can actually show them the numbers and quantify that the potential opportunity cost or what we could potentially, you know, gain by moving that on, it becomes more of an easier conversation. And then it becomes about an action plan and actually assisting them to offload or, you know, liquidate that asset.
Well, I think that's a really important point. In other words, we run numbers and figures because there are costs. There's the cost of capital gains tax, or maybe there isn't because it hasn't gone up in value, but there's selling costs and stamp duties. But if it's going to take 20 years to recoup those costs, you wouldn't sell your property. If, on the other hand, after 2 or 3 years, you've got a property that's going to start growing better and outperform in the long term, it's a worthwhile exercise. Of course, there's always other factors involved, Brett. If it's tenanted, maybe I'd be considering selling at the end of the lease when you widen the appeal, because selling a property with a tenant in place restricts your market to that small percentage that are investors. I'd rather have my property attractive to owner-occupiers. What would your discussion be if people say, hey, it's the wrong time to sell? It's not a good time in the market at the moment.
Sure. And that gets down to a number of factors as well. The lease is one of them. You're correct. You want as many people to buy that property as possible. So it isn't a fire sale, Michael. It's not we have to get rid of it today. We'll take any price. There is a certain amount of time when we've got to get that right. But again, you know, generally all things being equal, the longer you hold that property, the opportunity cost you're missing out on as well. So that's incredibly important to understand too. And the quicker we can liquidate the asset under favourable terms, the quicker we can move into to getting that asset and that money working for our client again.
I think that's a really good point, because the gap between your underperforming property and the better performing property will never be as small. So while it seems difficult today, as the better performing property is going to keep growing in value, the gap will widen. So to say it's not a good time now, I'll wait for the market to pick up, because see, the problem, of course, Brett, is that if you've got an underperforming property, and usually we want to sell the worst performing in the portfolio, that's often the hardest one to move, isn't it?
It is. It is, absolutely. You know, they're in the lowest amount of demand, and there's got to be a period of time that you're allowed to sell that underperforming asset.
But I suggest you treat your property investments like a business, and that's what all strategic property investors do. And that means you're going to understand that while it's costly to dispose of a dud property, and you may even take a loss financially, it's even more expensive to hold on to an underperforming property. And I know over the years I've explained to people that they should treat their properties like employees. Look, you've probably heard me say you should treat your properties like a business. And if that's the case, your properties are your employees. Think about it. Treat your properties like an employee. And if your employee came late to work, played on Twitter and Facebook or Instagram all day, took a long lunch, then came back, and they weren't in the mood to see your customers or your clients, what would you do? First of all, probably give them a performance review, which are the questions that we've just suggested that you talk about with each property annually. And then you'd probably have to retrench your employees. Now, sometimes you'd even have to pay a redundancy package to move them on. But the benefit of that is you could employ harder working people in your business. So it's really much the same with your properties. They're your employees in your real estate investment business, and they've got to work for you in the long term. If your properties aren't giving you wealth producing rates of return, you're just not going to achieve the financial freedom that you're looking for. As I say, I've heard investors say, I know this property isn't growing, but it's not costing me anything. You're never allowed to use that excuse again. You're not factoring in the opportunity costs. So, Brett, if people would like to catch up with you and have a chat and have a property performance portfolio review to be able to, did you like that alliteration, property performance portfolio review, would you be happy for them to have a chat with you to see how it's going and if their portfolio is going to help them achieve what they're looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very, very important to have a third party do that, Michael, and someone with a level of experience. You know, we're talking decades of experience. You've been in the game for a lot longer than I have, and I've been doing this for 20 years. So having that level of experience and market depth and also having, as we talked about before, maybe strategizing and putting some numbers down on paper to actually highlight and quantify just what that opportunity cost may be could actually be invaluable.
I think that's a great point, because just like a big mistake is to buy your properties emotionally, just as big a mistake is to make big investment decisions emotionally. So you shouldn't make 30-year decisions based on the last 30 minutes or 30 days or even 30 weeks of news. So it may not be necessary to sell your property, or you may have to plan to do it in the right order to minimize your tax. So if you're looking to get your ducks in a row to take advantage of the opportunities as the world becomes COVID normal, as we now call it, as our property markets pick up, there'll be a link in the show notes. Go to Metropole and have a chat with Brett and his team, where we can help you in a number of ways. We're going to give you some directions, some certainty, some clarity about how your current property portfolio is performing. And if you're a beginning investor, this is the right time to do things. So while a lot of people, Brett, seem to think we only help high net worth clients, and we do, a large percentage of our clients have got substantial portfolios, we love helping beginners because we don't want them to make the mistake that others have made. And I know over the time you've been with us, you've actually seen people start off and now have very substantial portfolios. So go to metropole.com.au, have a talk about our strategic property plans. You could use our buyer's agency services, property management, renovations, development, financial planning, wealth advisory. You may choose to use some of those services or the whole lot. And Brett, if they want to speak to you, you'd be available to have a chat with them. Would that be right?
Yeah, most certainly. I think you hit the nail on the head, Michael. I think we enjoy talking to people and helping people, and you know, we've made mistakes ourselves, so if we can point people in the direction and in the right direction and avoid those mistakes, then they're going to get further ahead themselves.
Fine. So as we said, it's normal to have underperforming properties as well as better performing properties. We've all made mistakes. If you're not sure how your property portfolio is performing, if you'd like a portfolio health check, if you'd like to take advantage of the opportunities that are clearly going to arise over the next couple of years. It's really interesting, Brett, how all the property pessimists, well, not the trolls on the internet, but all the economists have actually changed their forecast and are now seeing some great times ahead. If you'd like to be part of that and get some clarity, go to metropole.com.au and we'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey. Thanks for the chat again today, Brett.
Thanks, Michael. Great to talk.
In a moment, I'm going to share my mindset message with you with some life lessons from Bill Gates. I recently watched a documentary about Bill Gates, one of the world's wealthiest people, and it gave me a lot more respect for him and Melinda and the work they're doing. It also gave me some more insight into him. I also read an article about a graduation speech he gave, and we're going to discuss that in a moment, some great lessons from one of the world's wealthiest people. But before I do, just finishing off on my conversation with Brett Warren, if you're currently investing in property, the latest tax office statistics suggest it's unlikely you are going to achieve the financial success that you're looking for. Only a month or two ago, the figures shown by the tax department showed there were only 20,756 people of the 2.2 million property investors in Australia who own six or more properties. Now, interestingly, we did some statistics to see how those fit in with our clients at Metropole as a proportion. We got a lot more clients owning four, five, six properties, but that's a different matter. My question to you is, how is your property portfolio performing? Because you're going to be in that 1.9 million group of property investors, 1.9 million people who own one or two properties, or you're going to be that small group who eventually owns a substantial property portfolio. And will what you currently own help you achieve the financial success and choices you're looking for? How are you assessing this? Well, my team at Metropole would love to help you answer those questions by conducting a property portfolio health check. So go to metropole.com.au, leave your details. Let's have a chat. Let's see if we can help you. Because the health check's actually a strategic part, a critical part of our strategic property planning process. Now's the right time to get all your ducks in a row. So go to metropole.com.au, leave your details, and let us be part of your wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
As I mentioned, I recently read a speech given by Bill Gates at a high school where he talked about 11 things he didn't learn at high school. Now remember, Bill Gates is one of the richest people in the world. Clearly, after I've watched that documentary, a super intelligent person and seems like a nice guy. Sure, he's eccentric, but apparently he talked about how feel-good politically correct teachings created a generation of children with no concept of reality and how this concept set them up for failure in the real world. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Anyway, here are 10 of his life lessons. Number one, he said, life isn't fair. Get used to it. And if you've been around long enough, you will know that's true. Life doesn't owe you anything. You've got to make it happen. Okay, rule number two, the world won't care about your self-esteem. The world will expect you to accomplish something before you feel good about yourself. Remember, these are 10 lessons from Bill Gates, 10 life lessons. Rule number three was, you'll not make $60,000 a year right out of high school. You won't become vice president with a car phone until you earn both. Yeah, I guess there's a expectation of entitlement nowadays in many people, isn't there? Bill Gates' rule number four is, if you think a teacher's tough, wait till you get a boss. I understand what he's saying. Bill Gates' rule number five was, flipping burgers is not beneath your dignity. Your grandparents had a different word for burger flipping. They called it opportunity. I think I know what he's getting at. We're all wanting the fancy job straight out of school. Remember, he was speaking to a high school, to people leaving school, and he was telling them, be realistic with your expectations and don't look down on people or on jobs that you think are beneath you. His rule number six was, if you mess up, it's not your parents' fault, so don't whine about your mistakes, learn from them. Well, that's a lesson that comes through in a lot of these mindset messages, isn't it? Rule number seven, before you were born, your parents weren't as boring as they are now. They got that way from paying your bills, cleaning your clothes, listening to you talk about how cool you thought you were. So before you save a rainforest from the parasites of your parents' generation, try de-lousing the closet in your own room. Now, I like that one. You can imagine how that went down at the high school when he spoke about that. His rule number eight was, your school may have done away with winners and losers, but life has not. In some schools, they've abolished failing grades and they'll give you as many times as you want to get the answer right. This doesn't bear the slightest resemblance to anything in real life. And isn't that the truth? His rule number nine, Bill Gates' rule number nine. Life is not divided into semesters. You don't get summers off, and very few employers are interested in helping you find yourself. Do that on your own time. And lastly, his rule number 10 was, television isn't real life. In real life, people actually have to leave the coffee shop and go to jobs. Now, let me give you a rule number 10 that I think Bill Gates would have said as well. If he had an opportunity, he would have probably said, be nice to nerds. Chances are you may end up working for one. Well, there you have it. 10 life lessons from Bill Gates and one I threw in for good measure. Well, if you got some benefit from my chat with Brett or my discussion about Bill Gates, and you know somebody else who you think would get some benefit, please tell them about the Michael Yardney podcast. It would also be great if you told the world by leaving a review. 1 star, 5 star. They all seem to be 5 star. And that's great. On Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this podcast. And when you do, and I read it out, I'd love to gift you one of my books as a way of saying thank you. And recently, Beck Misher left a review on Apple Podcasts saying, great resource. Thank you. Thank you for this resource. It's been very helpful in learning about property investing from a strategic perspective. Well, thank you for your thoughts, Beck. And if you email me, michael@metropole.com.au, I'd love to gift you one of my books. I'll be back again real soon. In fact, twice a week with the Michael Yardney podcast. But in between, if you want to catch up with me, just look out for me on social media. Just look for Michael Yardney and you can find out a bit about what I'm up to, and I'd like to find out a bit more about you. And I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?